Welcome to the Republican Professor. I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather, and we're in Helmut Thielicke again, Ideology and Law. Let's get to it. In view of what has been said already, there is obviously no need to look for either a norm such as justice or an authority such as natural law in the communist system of law. They simply are not there. On the communist view, law cannot derive exclusively from the idea of justice. On the contrary, it involves, in principle, a tension between three basic values: justice, utility, and security. And there's a footnote. Gustav Broadbrook, and it's in German. I'm not going to even try. Right is a highly complex concept in as much as it combines both normative and pragmatic considerations. Although the relationship between the two is highly complex, and there are borderline cases in which the supremacy of the normative considerations over the pragmatic is in doubt, there can be no question that in the Western legal tradition, justice is regarded as an absolute of equal standing with such other absolutes as the good, the true, and the beautiful. One might say that law is a cultural phenomenon involving the externals of the social order, which, quote, is designed to express and support the idea of what is right. Thus, the body of laws always has as its core the idea of justice. The normative outlook prevails as a continuing corrective to all the pragmatisms which also come in to play. Where are we at? We're in page 41, 42 of Helmut Thielicke's Theological Ethics, Volume 2, Politics. We want to thank Fortress Press for making this material available. Go to fortresspress.com to see their catalog, and to I would highly recommend you purchase the book to follow along. They also have lots of other great titles, including Jesus and the Victory of God, Jesus and the New Testament, and the People of God. Great stuff. Good stuff. N.T. Wright is not always insightful on contemporary politics, but he is certainly an excellent New Testament historian. Helmut Thielicke, as you know, as we've covered many times on this podcast, has two doctorates. He taught at the University of Hamburg in West Germany for a long time. He thought deeply about both kinds of socialism, national socialism and communistic socialism, both on the left. I guess this is my left. I guess that's your right. Both on the left. And he was very concerned. He's writing about law. The communists pervert law. So do the national socialists. He's using the term Western legal tradition to be as opposed to communism, as opposed to socialism. Ideological law, however, bears the mark of heresy. We're going to make a fair use of this material. We're doing a transformative reading here with contemporary commentary. Ideological law, however, bears the mark of heresy, of legal heresy, because it absolutizes the subsidiary outlook. Pragmatism, no longer significant only as a part of the total organism, is made the organizing center. Law becomes an instrument of the will to power. a political weapon. Just as science exists to justify pragmatic ideology, so law exists to justify legally the interests of the system by making the idea of justice subservient to them. He's talking about how socialists conceive of law. It's a weapon. It's a practical tool for power. Does that sound familiar to you? We're recording this on Friday, November 15th, 2024. Does that sound familiar to you? I have a PhD in public law. I also spent 6 years in seminary. And I taught philosophy for a long time. Well, long for me. I mean, I haven't been around that long, but 2 decades. I think that's a long time, but I guess the older I get, it might not feel very long. And I think he's thought pretty deeply about this stuff. You think of law, think of law as a pragmatic thing, like what he's talking about, instead of just an issue of justice. Well, you might wonder, in Aristotle's conception of justice, is there any pragmatic element there? Or is he excluding that from the very idea of justice? Justice is a hard thing to define. But I think what he's saying here is that ideological law bears the mark of heresy, as he says, because pragmatism is the rule for what is in the interests of justice. Let's continue. In the early stages, the purely pragmatic ends of the ideology are still manifest without any concealment. But then the inherent urge for expansion, which slumbers in them, comes to the fore. It finds expression not only in external power conflicts, but in its conquest of what we might call the arsenal of norms present in the human consciousness. The ideologists note that this conquest increases their power potential. They invest their use of force with the trappings of legality, thus making it harder for anyone to oppose them in the name of law. This is great. This neutralizes some of the opposition and at the same time attains some of the secret goals of ideological power, which aims not merely at an external consolidation of power by means of terror, but at a conquest of the inner spheres of man, including his conscience. Practical application of this. Last night I was at a cigar event. I was talking to a law enforcement officer of 28 years, state police. And he spent his career at one of the major University of California campuses here. And we were talking about the different ways that police officers can get in trouble in the state of California. And one of them was if it's students he's typically interacting with, pulling them over and, stuff like that for violations on campus. And if the student tells you that they have pronouns that are they would like you to use the third personal pronouns, they would want you to use of them in your report and in interacting with them that don't match proper English usage. The policy is that you go with the student's preferences, or I mean, whoever it is, if student or not, even if it's incorrect English. And what I mean by incorrect English is, in the English language, and pretty much in any language in the history of man, the speaker is the one that decides which third personal pronouns the speaker wants to use. And the pronoun usage is correct if, in the speaker's judgment, the pronoun matches the gender of what you're talking about, or the person of what you're talking about. So, for example, there's an impersonal pronoun, it, that would be inappropriate to use for a human being. It doesn't matter what someone tells you. If someone comes up and tells you, say it for me, that's my pronoun, it would be incorrect usage to use the word it in that case, because it does not refer to a human being. It refers to a non-human being, like a computer, like a vehicle, like an article of clothing, like a dog. Usually dogs, we prefer, we don't get to wait for the dog to tell us what gender it is. We look what gender it is, because it's a matter of looking, because dogs don't wear clothes. And so oftentimes we human beings use the he or she for dogs because it's apparent and it's appropriate. We might not do it for flies, because I don't know whether a fly is a he or a she just by looking, and frankly, I don't really care about flies. So I will say the word it for a fly. But sometimes we inappropriately use the term it to refer to human beings if they're unborn, and that's a pro-choice way of talking. Well, anyway, this guy's telling me, that they could complain and stuff like that. There's no way it could be law. That's what Tillich is saying. That's an ideological use of law, to try to distort the use of language and come up with new rules on the fly that empower suspects or something like that against the police. Empower them to have quote unquote legitimate complaints. Well, no, it's just a power struggle at that point. If you want to talk differently, that's fine. But you can't make me talk differently. You can't make me violate the rules of language and stuff. It has nothing to do with respect. I understand the concern that there'd be a policy that the police officer is supposed to respect the person that they're interacting with. But the limits of respect don't go so far as to disrespect the English language. That would make no sense. And that's disrespectful to the officer and anybody else listening who can speak English. That's just manipulative. I hope you're able to follow what I'm saying here. The rule is that the speaker makes a judgment of what the appropriate pronoun is and uses that. If it's an adult human male, it's a man. If it's an adult human female, it's a woman. If it's younger, the object that you're talking about, I'm using the word it just for the sake of referring to an object. But as we get more specific about what that object is, if that object, it becomes apparent that that object is female human, depending on the age, we say girl or woman. Sometimes we say girl for older women, just It's just a way of talking. It'd be very odd to say woman for a young girl. Unless you say young woman, it would be very odd to say woman for a baby. But the gender is determined by the sex. In the same way, if you look up the term man in the dictionary, adult human, let's do that right now. Let's look at Noah Webster's dictionary, okay? I'm going to pause this. Okay, I'm going to share my screen and we're going to look up the word man. Okay. Noah Webster, 1828 dictionary. And we're going to look up the word man. Oops. No. Man. For those of you who are only hearing this and you can't see, I'll read it. Noah Webster, 1828. Mankind, the human race, the whole species of human beings, beings distinguished from all other animals by the powers of reason and speech, as well as by their shape and dignified aspect. And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness and let him have dominion. In other words, the image of God. And the rest of the examples are from scripture. Pretty cool. Number two, male individual of the human race of adult growth or years. This is just English language here, people. Okay. It's not that hard. Three, a male of the human race. Four, a servant or an attendant of the male sex. Five, a word of familiar address, like, hey, man. Okay, you got several definitions of MAN there. Well, he is the corresponding third personal pronoun for all of those uses of man, including the gender neutral one. So, accordingly, we look at the US Constitution, Article 2. This creates the presidency. Article 2 of the US Constitution. The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. He shall hold his office. Well, there's some gen th those are gender neutral third personal pronouns. How do I know they're gender neutral? Well, because Kamala Harris was just running for president and she lost, thank God. But she never said, hey, we need to amend the Constitution because Article 2, Section 1, which creates the presidency, which would be like what I have, only applies to he people. Now, well, it does apply to he people, but that's because of the t use of the term man. It means mankind, the human race. It's gender neutral in the primary sense. All men are created equal. As in the Declaration of Independence, which we're going to get to here. The second paragraph, all men are created equal. 1776. That has a corresponding third personal pronoun, also used here in Article 2, Section 1 of the US Constitution. He, his. gender neutral. Everybody knows that. Hillary knew that. Kamala knew that. That's why there's no push for a really quick, let's amend the Constitution so that women can be president. Everybody knows this is gender neutral and it's appropriate. It corresponds to the gender neutral sense of man. But also, if you happen to know that a human being is a male, that's the appropriate one in terms of gender. Now, what am I trying to say here, guys? I'm giving you a contemporary example of ideological use of law by leftists, by socialists. They want to train, they want to try to use the trappings of law not to just terrorize you exactly, because this police officer wasn't exactly terrorized, but to confuse you, to confuse your conscience, to make it look like it's legitimate law because it's about respect, to change the language here. It's about respect. Well, it's not about respect. That's false. I don't necessarily like Hitler. I might respect him in the sense that I respect the power that he had and the fact that he did do things that influence history. I mean, it's kind of hard to ignore that. I mean, doesn't mean I like him, but I use the word he to refer to Hitler, and I don't ask him what he wants me to use. I use the word he because it seems quite likely, as I look at the historical record, that was a male individual of the human race. I'm using English correctly. Has nothing to do with whether I like the person or respect them. So you're interacting as a police officer with an individual and they appear to you to be male, it's perfectly appropriate to use the word he. And there's nothing that they can say about it, that other person. Now, I used the word they just then, and you might say, well, why did you use the word they? Well, that's because there's a rule in the English language. And the correct usage of English language means you can use the word they for a single individual if you don't know the gender. And we do this all the time. It might be that you get a report of someone that committed a crime, like let's say vandalism, and they're wearing a mask. Well, I use the word they because not because it's more than one, but because I don't know if it's male or female, and I just use the word it, right? It is either a male or a female, but it's not appropriate to use the word it. You try to get more information. Once you find out it's a female, then you use the word she. You don't use the word they, and you don't use the word it. The word is she. So in context where information is unavailable, all you know is it's a human being. Okay, well, you're supposed to use he or she. Well, but if you don't know, then it's appropriate to use the word they. But when you find out later that they are really a woman, then you're supposed to use the word she. In any case, it's up to the discretion of the speaker under those rules, not the listener. Not the person being talked about. And that's just an example of what he's talking about. Let me read this part again in Tilica. The ideologists note that this conquest increases their power potential. They invest their use of force with the trappings of legality, thus making it harder for anyone to oppose them in the name of law. See, that's what this officer was talking about. It's hard to oppose this in the name of law because the manipulation occurs within the trappings of legality. This neutralizes some of the opposition and at the same time attains some of the secret goals of ideological power, which aims not merely at an external consolidation of power by means of terror, but at a conquest of the inner spheres of man, including his conscience. In other words, they try to get you to violate your conscience. And they try to get you to have a change of conscience, meaning you have a conflict within yourself about values. I'm supposed to respect this person, but I'm also supposed to not lie. If I think this is a man, I'm not supposed to lie about that. That seems weird. So I have a conflict. And it seems like the law itself is telling me to disregard my own conscience. And because I have a sincere respect for the other person and for the rule of law, then this becomes a conquest of the inner spheres of man, is what he's talking about. Hence, it is in keeping with the way ideological power is exercised that public trials leading to a predetermined result are staged. These are no more than a power play in legal guise. It's called lawfare. The dominant power interest might well have attained its objective without its juridical interlude, but by using a moral instrument as well, by the investiture of justice as a handmaiden of politics, it can invade also the inner spheres of man. Even the obnoxious lack of credibility which attaches to such perversions of justice does not cause those in power to fail completely of their purpose. For the staged trial at least prevents the spectators from bringing the full emotional weight of their sense of justice to bear against the excesses of naked power, thus being forced now to wrestle with certain legal considerations. They are thus entangled in a debilitating debate with themselves. This is lawfare. Politics by law. They are confronted with a situation which is undoubtedly more complicated than that which would have been posed by an undisguised abuse of power. Since complicated situations are less easily handled, even inwardly, than those which are simple and straightforward, their moral powers of resistance are dissipated. This precisely is the secret goal of all ideological strategy, something which Trotsky failed to see in the early days of communism. He proclaimed an open tyranny which was to be established without any concealment, without transposing the dictatorship of the proletariat into enigmatic legal forms. The more debilitation which results from this pragmatic combining of interests and law may be seen in its most radical form, not among the people generally who are spectators at the trials, but in the defendants themselves, where it leads to those self-incriminations and expressions of remorse which are so puzzling to the West. He uses the term West to mean non-communist, non-socialist, and non-national socialist. Sometimes people just say the right. Since defendants usually demand their own execution and hence could not be hoping to gain anything through their self-accusations, their strange conduct is usually explained in terms of psychological pressures, the power of suggestion, drugs, torture, brainwashing. While there may be a measure of truth in all this, the real explanation lies in the ideological structure of the law itself. In this connection, the statements made by the old Hungarian communist, I don't know how to say that name, LAJOSCSEBY. About the rehabilitations of, I don't know how to say that name either, LASZLORAJK. Minister of the Interior, who had been executed in 1949, are most significant for our analysis since they contain a personal diagnosis of the man's history and therefore shed a light from within on these puzzling procedures. When asked why those being rehabilitated in 1956 had confessed their guilt and solemnly expressed remorse 7 years before, CSEBY answered, "Do not think that the matter is so simple. When we were in the capitalist prisons, we were interrogated by our enemies, but now we are being questioned by representatives of our own Communist Party. They claim to speak in the names of the party, and they demanded that we confess regardless of what might happen to us personally, because such confession was in the interests of the party and of the workers' movement. And even if in the depth of our souls we suspected that this was not so, we nonetheless came gradually to believe the constantly repeated phrases." The constantly repeated phrases. We nonetheless came to gradually to believe the constantly repeated phrases. My pronouns are. You don't have any pronouns. Nobody does. The pronouns don't belong to you. They belong to the language itself. And if you're a speaker of the language, and if you're a competent speaker of the language, well, then you can avail yourself of them. But you don't have any right to tell me to disregard the rules of my own language. You don't have that right. This is me applying it to the issue of the police officer I mentioned about. Wow. The ground, the moral support, was cut away from beneath our feet, and then we confessed. Here in CSEBY's statement, all the pragmatic tendencies of ideological law are present in summary form. Damn. That's really sad. In our tradition, we have a right against self-incrimination. That's what he talks about the West. Well, I think we're, I'm an Americanist here. I think the way that our system is designed is pretty freaking cool, man. I think most of it was great. So we got US Constitution, and we've got Bill of Rights, Fifth Amendment. Let's check it out. What do you say? Well, the Fifth Amendment protects criminal defendants from having to testify if they may incriminate themselves through the testimony. What a concept. What a concept. No, I don't want to support you, Cornell Law. You have a huge endowment. What do you, how dare you? How dare you ask me for money? No person shall be held to answer for capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on presentment of indictment. And guess what? You don't have to be a witness against himself. 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 There's another pronoun. Looky there. Looky there. Hold up. Yo, hold up. I don't like these summaries. I'd rather just read the damn thing. See? Himself. corresponds to the person, meaning man, human being, the gender neutral sense. Well, the communists, the socialists, the national socialists, they think that there's nothing wrong with forcing you to testify against yourself. This is, first of all, the aim of the trial. The accused represent an opposition which must be robbed of its moral foundations. Their confession accomplishes that. Opposition cannot rally behind leaders and champions who liquidate themselves. Martyrs forcefully done to death are the seed of the church or of the group which they represent, but martyrs who voluntarily recant discredit their group and blunt its purpose. The purpose of the trials is to provide the technical possibility for this sterilization, this inner liquidation of opposing groups. As this is the task of the law, its pragmatic character is vividly apparent. In the second place, the pragmatic character of the law is shown in the relation between the court and the accused, for the technique of interrogation is designed to weaken the defendant by entangling him in a twofold conflict, thus making him the agent of the sterilization process. I'm on page 44. On the one hand, the defendant is entangled in the conflict between party interest and law. The tactical goal of the hearing is to resolve this conflict in such a way that the accused no longer regards the law as an authority standing above both sides in the trial, mediating between the rights of the party and his own rights. The law instead becomes identical with the rights of the party. It is simply an instrument of the party's interests. Thus, this first conflict ends to the detriment of the accused in a conjoining of law and interest to the point where they completely overlap. Page 45. This is in a section called the Pragmatism of the of Idolatry of the Ideologies. And remember, Helmut Thielicke has two doctorates, one in philosophy and one in theology. On the other hand, the defendant is also entangled in the debilitating conflict of the party within itself, i.e., the conflict between the party as he represents it and the party as his accusers represent it. That's a deep point right there. Since here he is not facing a hostile front as he would be in relation to capitalism, since he has no quarrel against communism but represents a quarrel within it, it is not a case of his being one or two opposing factors in a conflict. The conflict is rather a battle of two souls within his own breast. He does not stand on the battlefield. He is the battlefield. The weakening and neutralizing of the opposition accomplished by this inner conflict ends in full capitulation because one of those two voices in the same breast is continually strengthened from the outside. That is, by the government against the individual. The accusing party, whose voice is heard also within the defendant himself, strengthens this voice by the constant action of its prosecutors and court officials. Notice this is always the government against the individual, even in the communist system, even the socialist, national socialists, what he's calling ideologies. Their monotonous arguments, incessantly repeated by a variety of persons, finally drown out the lonely voice of opposition. Wow. I would highly recommend you take a look at A Day in the Life, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. It's a wonderful novel. That's all I'm going to say. Take a look at it. This is all the easier because the duet of voices in engaged in a debate that is essentially about interests, not about law, a debate which solely for the sake of external effect must finally issue a legal formulation, i.e., a confession and judgment. This debate about interests takes place in such a way that party unity takes priority over everything else. I'm on page 45. In this, both accusers and accused are in agreement that party unity must be maintained if the party is to remain in power. Now, the moment of the struggle for power is decided in such a way that one faction remains in control while the defeated antagonist sits in prison. The obligation of unity, recognized by both groups, can be discharged only by submission on the part of the defeated faction, that is, the individual against the government. The unity of the party can be restored only by their moral capitulation, their acknowledgement of guilt, and expression of remorse. This is how the potentially dangerous situation of martyrdom is neutralized. Ideological law, that is, socialist law, national socialist, communist socialist, basically the Democratic Party. Now, ideological law is made into a power tool in the hands of the ruling class. In an interclass dispute, it becomes a power tool in the hands of the dominant faction. It is used, and this is the only reason that law is necessary at all in ideological tyranny, to resolve certain debilitating and paralyzing conflicts. The best example of this usage is to be seen in these personal confessions and self-incriminations on the part of the accused at public trials. To sum up, law is, quote, the totality of the rules of human conduct imposed by the state power, acting in behalf of the ruling class in society and of the customs and rules whose usage is sanctioned by that power and enforced by the machinery of state in order to maintain, strengthen, and develop those conditions and circumstances which are acceptable and advantageous to the ruling class, unquote. And that is a quote from basically a communist. And it's in German, but I can tell he's a communist because it's published in Moscow, 1949. That's how I know. Because Moscow in 1949 did not publish anything besides communist stuff. Yeah. Indeed, we append some typical statements to illustrate, sometimes in the crassest form, the pragmatic character of ideological law. The significance for law of the social consciousness may be seen in the fact that for Soviet law, proof consists, quote, consists not in the establishing of facts after the Roman pattern, but in the judging of these facts, unquote. That's footnote 18. Same author. It's in German, but it's communist, I can tell. Why? Because it's published in East Berlin, 1952. And they only published communist stuff. In other words, he's telling you how the communists see law. Notice that this definition leaves room for a judgment. By the way, if you have to pause this and go get a drink of water, come back, do that. If you have to pause this and rewind a little bit and listen to something again, do that. You're in control. Listen to it as many times as you want. If you didn't quite catch it the first time, just listen to it again. It's normal. I have to listen to things several times sometimes. It's normal. If you're not quite getting all this, don't worry. If you're getting a little bit of it or most of it, great. Keep going. Go back over it. Notice this definition leaves room for judgment, a judgment, and ideological evaluation of facts not yet established. The criterion of truth is thus subordinated to the goal of the proceedings. That is exactly how Title IX investigations work on campus under Democrat rule in the United States of America, in the guise of civil rights. Why would there be a civil rights portion of the Department of Education? Trump wants to get rid of the Department of Education. You have a civil right to teach your kids according to your own conscience. You have a civil right to do that. You have a civil right not to be abused by the Department of Education. That is not a right that will be vindicated by the Department of Education, whether they call it civil rights or not. This, quote, judging is particularly prominent, quote, in matters involving social, i.e., class relationships, and where the act in question represents a threat to society from the standpoint of the interests of socialism, unquote. That's a quotation from the same source. From the same source. Quote, the courts in our Soviet state, and he's quoting the original sources, by the way. He's reading the original German and Russian. The courts in our, this is a quotation, quote, the courts in our Soviet state are part of the machinery of political guidance, and appropriate measures assure that they are actually instruments of the policy of the Communist Party, unquote. The court, and here's another quote, the court exists not to replace terror, but to justify it in principle, clearly, openly, and relentlessly. That is a quotation from V.I. Lenin at the conclusion of his address, April 29th, 1918, to the All-Russian Central Executive Committee. That's published in Berlin, 1960, volume 27. The courts of the state are instruments for classes to oppress classes. To the hostile classes, the state apparatus is the instrument of oppression. It is violent. It is not benevolent, unquote. That is from Mao Zedong on People's Democratic Dictatorship, Beijing, 1949. In Darkness at Noon, Arthur Koestler has given a notable literary presentation of ideological trial and punishment. And that's the end of the section. The next one is Ideologies as Idolatry. I'm going to enjoy that one. And that one is a doozy. Ideologies as Idolatry. That's going to be a longer one, a little bit longer. But it will be worth it. I hope you got something out of this. If you did, send a donation at the Republican Professor on Venmo. You can also buy me a cup of coffee in the link that I'll put there, Lucas J. Mather. I've enjoyed this time with you, and I'm so glad that the election went decently last week. There was no red wave. You're misunderstanding it if you think that. The American people are incredibly fickle. We must solidify our understanding of these things in order to secure the blessings of liberty the way our system was designed for the future generations. God bless you. See you next time.